Well, good evening, and thank you all very much for coming, and a warm welcome to Emmanuel College for the 14th annual Intellectual Property Law Lecture, which is funded by the bequest of Dr. Herschel Smith. So I'm Fiona Reynolds, I'm the master here, and it's my privilege to introduce tonight's lecturer, Professor Ansgar Oley, who holds the Chair of Civil, Intellectual Property and Competition Law from Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich. Came to Munich from his role as head of the Commonwealth section of the Max Planck Institute for Intellectual Property and Competition Law and professor at the University of Beirut. He holds law degrees from the University of Bonn, Cambridge and Munich. So Ansgar Oley is a remarkable scholar engaged with and an authority on all areas of IP, trademarks, patents, copyright and unfair competition, as well as civil law. Today, most scholars specialise in one area, but not Ansgar. Indeed, along with Professor Annette Kaur, who gave the eighth lecture here in 2013, and it's lovely to see you here again tonight, Ansgar is recognised throughout Europe as one of the leading academic voices in the field. Perhaps as a result of that, it would take me far too long to list his publications, all of which I gather are regarded as essential reading by your peers. But your most recent important works include books on comparative advertising, privacy and publicity rights, and the Europeanization of IP, and most recently, hugely important papers on the Unified Patent Court Agreement and the implications of Brexit for the UK's ability to participate in the proposed Unified Patent Court. Now, since most of us are kind of wondering what's happening on Brexit today, you may have something to say to us about that. You're also, as I understand, the co-editor of GRUR, the leading German intellectual property law journal. Ansgar, you have strong connections with the UK. You're an honorary bencher of the Middle Temple, and you've given the annual Intellectual Property Bar Association lecture and is a visiting professor at Oxford, from where you've just come, I understand. In Cambridge, Ansgar did his LLM at Cambridge in Trinity Hall, where perhaps one suspects he first became fascinated by the English legal system, and perhaps also fascinated with the English English language, because as we'll hear, he speaks it more beautifully, inspiringly and entertainingly than many more locally reared academics. And tonight, the subject on which he's going to inspire us is hybrids between intellectual property and unfair competition law. Over to you, Ansgar.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you very much for inviting me here. It is a great honor to be invited to give this lecture, particularly so because my intellectual property life started in Cambridge. So if you allow me, I would like to start on a personal note. When I first came to Cambridge as an LLM student in 1991, I had never heard of intellectual property law before. And then I decided to choose intellectual property as one of my four LLM options. It was mainly taught by Professor Cornish, who is with us here today. And I soon became fascinated with his style of teaching and with the entire subject of intellectual property. And so it was here in Cambridge that I decided to do a doctorate in that area. I was particularly interested in the areas where common law perspectives and civil law perspectives really differed. And so my idea for a doctorate was to look at unfair competition law and in particular the types of legal reasoning. So I approached Professor Bayer, who was then the director of the Munich Max Planck Institute, asking him whether he was willing to supervise my doctorate, and he said, oh, this topic is interesting because I talked about something along those lines in my Herschel Smith lecture. And so there we are. So Cambridge is connected to my own vita, to my own ways into intellectual property in several respects. And I will actually a little bit return to my roots that I explored in my doctorate today, because I would like to speak about hybrids. Now, a hybrid, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is anything derived from heterogeneous sources or composed of different or incongruous elements having a mixed character. So, for instance, between a combustion engine and an electric car, a hybrid would combine characteristics of the two. And the keen golfers among you will not only have woods and irons in your bag, but also one or several hybrids. Now, hybrids have already attracted the attention of intellectual property scholars. There is, for instance, a seminal article by Professor Reichmann who looked at intellectual property hybrids. His starting point was slightly different from mine this evening because he looked at hybrids between the copyright and the patent law paradigm, of which he was actually quite critical. I will look at a different kind of hybrids, namely hybrids between intellectual property on the one hand and other forms of liability, namely tort law, unfair competition law, trade practices law, and the like. I will propose two things. First of all, I will try to argue that these hybrids are there and that they are getting increasingly important. And I will secondly try to show that parts of intellectual property law are also in a process of hybridization, moving away from the clear property paradigm. Now, at the beginning, there are two objections against this choice of topic. First of all, in order to speak about hybrids, we would have to know what property is and what intellectual property is. Now, you're aware that the scholarship on this question fills entire libraries. Should we conceive of property as a right, as a relation between a person and an object, as a right in rem, or as Blackstone would have it, as the sole and despotic dominion of a man over an object of the external world? Or should we rather adopt the view that property is a bundle of rights with corresponding duties, as proposed by Hofeld, for instance? And can we speak about intellectual property at all, or should we follow the lead of the Max Planck Institute in Munich and discard the term intellectual property altogether and rather speak about innovation and competition? Well, I think without going too much into property theory, I think we can refer to intellectual property. And if we try to define what intellectual property is, it probably has an intangible object as a point of reference. I'm not adopting Blackstone, and I'm not saying that property is a relation between a person and an object, but an intangible object is the point of reference. And so intellectual property rights are bundles of rights. There are typical rights that of which intellectual property rights consist. So, for instance, the exclusive right to use, and particularly the exclusive right to make and sell the intangible object. This right is combined with an enforceable duty on the part of everyone else to abstain from these uses. Also, intellectual property rights are usually assignable and licensable. So I think this is a working definition without going too much into property theory that helps us to go on from here. The second objection is that when I'm talking about IP hybrids, this sounds like a boring exercise in classification. When I prepared my talk, I had to think of one passage in Peter Carey's excellent novel Oscar and Lucinda towards the beginning, where young Oscar classifies his collection of buttons. I quote, "He lined them up, he ordered them, he numbered them. There were 506, there were 560. Sometimes in the middle of a new arrangement, his head ached." So it sounds a little bit as if talking about hybrids might be a head-aching exercise in classification, whereas these days intellectual property research really should be about policy. Shouldn't we be fighting against Article 11 and Article 13 of the draft DSM directive rather than classifying intellectual property rights here? Well, my reaction to that would be twofold. First of all, I think that policy without proper doctrine is blind. I'm very convinced of that. And secondly, there will be some policy implications of my talk, although I admit right away that the analytic side of my talk is much easier than the policy side, to which I will come towards the end. So, I will look at my topic in three steps. First of all, I will look at hybrids below the intellectual property threshold. Secondly, I will look at some in classical intellectual property rights and try to show what I mean by hybridization. And finally, I'll end up with some tentative conclusions. So first of all, hybrids below the IP threshold, there are three of them that I would like to address. Firstly, and most obviously, trade secrets. Secondly, what in American parlance would be rights of publicity. And thirdly, misappropriation doctrines. First of all, trade secrets. A lot has been written about the question whether there is a property right in trade secrets or in confidential information if we adopt the English law classification. The prevailing view seems to be no, there is no such property right. Because first of all, there is no patent type exclusive right in information. First of all, trade secret law does not extend to the independent creation of this information. Reverse engineering is allowed. All that is different from what we know from patent law, for example. Also, confidential information law, trade secrets law, refers to flexible standards of fairness, as does Article 39 of the TRIPS Agreement. It refers to unfair competition. While there may be something like trade secret licensing, one might claim that it's just a weak form of licensing. It heavily relies on contracts, what one party is allowed to do and what one party is not allowed to do. Remedies are more flexible than intellectual property remedies. And quite often, the doctrinal question of whether trade secrets are property is combined with the policy question of how strong trade secret protection should be. So many claim that a proprietary protection would just go too far. It would excessively interfere with competition and with the freedom of expression. However, there is also the counter opinion. Some say, yes, trade secrets are property because, after all, confidential information is of commercial value. And trade secret law does give you the possibility to exclude others from using this information under certain conditions which relate to the act of misappropriation. But then this is nothing new. This is what we experience in trademark law too, where we don't get a full monopoly, but only protection against certain types of misappropriation. There is assignment and licensing. There are remedies which are pretty close to intellectual property remedies, although they may not be entirely the same. And finally, there is even a policy argument for understanding trade secret law as a branch of property law. The proprietary perspective might have a surprising virtue, as Professor Lemley called it, the surprising virtue of allowing a clearer imitation of limitation of the scope of the right and the framing of exemptions. Now, I don't take sides here. My own view is very much agnostic. My own view is the view of trade secret protection being a hybrid between pure tort law actions or pure unfair competition actions on the one hand and what you might call a perfect intellectual property right, such as a patent. Trade secrets have some of the elements of property and they lack other elements of property. And I don't even think that the classification matters for policy purposes. If we look at one of the questions that were very much disputed in the European Parliament in the course of the passing of the trade secret directive, namely the protection of whistleblowers, I would claim that the classification of property or non-property has no impact whatsoever on this question and that one should focus on the policy question rather than on the classification. Let me move on, let's take a look at the Trade Secrets Directive. Admittedly, this directive is more interesting in my country than it is in this country, where legislation decided that actually English law protects everything that is mentioned in the Trade Secrets Directive already. So the English or the UK implementation of that directive is rather an explanation or a commentary on the law of breach of confidence, whereas in Germany, the new Trade Secrets Act will change many things. We will get an entirely new legislation there. Now, this directive tells us that it does not create any exclusive right to know-how or information, so no intellectual property. But then when we read the directive, it provides for conditions of protection, scope of protection, exceptions, and remedies, very much like we know it from intellectual property law. The directive even refers to infringing goods that defines them in a rather broad and arguably too broad way. And the remedies are also modeled on the IP Enforcement Directive. So a cynical observer might refer to recital 16 as a Magritte-type recital. This is not a pipe. This is a well-known Magritte picture. And you might say, when the directive says this is not intellectual property, that's a little bit Magritte. So I wouldn't say that the directive creates a new intellectual property right. But I would say that the directive is moving trade secret law a little bit further up on the arrow of propertization. Let me move on to my second example, namely what American lawyers would call the right of publicity, which in American law emerged from privacy protection. And it's actually quite interesting to read the first case in which the publicity right was openly acknowledged, the Halen Laboratories case, in which the court said, I quote, "Whether it be labeled a property right is immaterial, for here, as often elsewhere, the tag property simply symbolizes the fact that courts enforce a claim which has pecuniary worth." So this is quite interesting. That's the bundle of rights theory. There are some parts of the bundle, and it doesn't really matter whether we call it property. I think American lawyers these days would see the right of publicity as an intellectual property right, although this is criticized in literature. German law is once again different. In German law, there is a monistic personality right, which protects privacy and the economic right. And as such, it would also doctrinally be seen as being distinct from property, whereas in fact, the protection is very much IP-like. Which brings me to English law, and which brings me to Miss Fenty, also known as Rihanna. Now, many of you will be familiar with this case. Rihanna took action against Topshop, which sold this particular t-shirt bearing her picture without her consent. Now, in English law, there is no such thing as a publicity right or an image right, however much various celebrities may wish they were, if I may quote Mr. Justice Burse here. So the case was litigated on the basis of passing off. Mr. Justice Burse found there to be goodwill. Rihanna is a world-famous pop star. She has a cool, edgy image and so on. And the difficult bit is, of course, misrepresentation. Because when people buy a t-shirt with the picture of Rihanna on it, they arguably just want the t-shirt and they don't really care whether Rihanna is behind it or whether there is any sort of commercial relation. Nevertheless, Mr. Justice Burse found on the facts of the case that there was misrepresentation because there had been a prior commercial connection between Rihanna and Topshop because the picture was an official picture taken from an album and so on and so forth. The Court of Appeal affirmed and also stressed that this was a classic passing off case and stressed the specific features on the basis of which the judge had been entitled to find misrepresentation. But if you look at this case, the effect is that Rihanna's brand value, of which she is very conscious, actually, and which she licenses and merchandises quite frequently, that this brand value was basically treated as a licensable commodity. Rihanna could have given her consent, and she could have given her consent for money. And in this particular respect, we are not as far away from the American model of publicity rights as the doctrinal basis might suggest. When we get to personal information or to private information, there are several other features in legal systems which I might mention here. I don't have the time to investigate them all in detail. Let me just flag them out. First of all, in English law, if we look at personal information, the case to think of is, of course, the Douglas and Hello case, in which the Douglases were entitled to sue a competing magazine which had published photos of their wedding. So the Douglases were entitled to derive a commercial profit from selling the pictures of their wedding. And the House of Lords also upheld not only the Douglas's action, but also the action of the magazine which had received the license, if we may call it that way. Lord Hoffman said that the court was not creating an unorthodox form of intellectual property rights, but at the same time, he reminded us to keep our eyes firmly fixed on the money. So what the court was arguably accepting here was some sort of publicity licensing, although it was called differently. There are a couple of other questions involved here. One interesting question to think of at the moment is, how about personal data as a payment for internet services? How does that fit in within our intellectual property system? And talking about data, there is, of course, the huge question of whether there should be a right in industrial data. I would just like to point out a change of the Japanese Unfair Competition Act, which now protects data which are protected by electromagnetic measures against unlawful acquisition, use, or disclosure along the lines of trade secrets law. So in Japan, these data are protected. They don't have to be secret. They only have to be protected by some sort of technical protection measures. Finally, my last point that I will also only talk about very briefly are misappropriation doctrines. Now, of course, in English law, there is no tort of misappropriation outside passing off and outside intellectual property law, but in many other countries, there is. Let me take Germany as an example, where the marketing of an imitated product can be unfair under unfair competition law if additional factors are present. So here we don't find full intellectual property protection. We only find tort law protection against some type of tortious behavior. But the effects are that this type of protection really adds on to intellectual property law. What are these factors? Well, causing confusion, that's a little bit like passing off. Taking unfair advantage or causing detriment to reputation, something we know from trademark law. And finally, as the German Supreme Court recently held, obstruction if the imitation is made systematically and if several parts of a series, for instance, are being imitated. One can take issue with that and one can ask, well, how can it be that one individual imitation is legal, whereas a systematic imitation is illegal? But there you are, a kind of intellectual property type protection which relies heavily on the individual circumstances of the particular act. Let me cite a Danish example, which you may have read about on IPCAT recently. The Danish Supreme Court recently found that the use of this bowl here, which was found to be protected by copyright law, was not only an infringement of copyright law, but that it was also unfair competition. Now, the Danish court accepted that there was a de minimis doctrine in copyright law. Not all of these pictures were infringing. Some were, others were not. But the court also said that the unfair use of the picture was against honest trade practices. And as far as my Danish colleagues, particularly Professor Skuusbo, tell me, the reasons for the court to find that were the individual circumstances of the act. Co-op had promised for a long time to take out a license and not to use this picture without a license, but nevertheless, they had gone ahead, and this may have prompted the court to grant protection. Finally, when we speak about misappropriation, we should also look at US law and at hot news misappropriation. There is this intriguing case of Barclays Capital and the fly on the wall. Barclays Capital, as other banks, had collected information which was relevant for the stock exchange and which was given to commercial subscribers, information that would influence their decision whether to buy or to sell shares. And the fly on the wall had managed to get hold of this information and published this information on their website. Barclays Capital sued them. They sued them on the basis of copyright law, but also on the basis of misappropriation. There is this doctrine in US law, which is called hot news misappropriation, the surviving rest of the INS and AP case in American law. It has certain conditions, for instance, that the information was gathered at a cost, that the defendant is free riding, and that the incentive to produce such information would be undermined without this protection. What is quite intriguing is that the district court did grant a remedy. But the remedy was not a protection of this information for 70 years after the life of the author, but it was protection for 1.5 hours after the opening of the stock exchange. So the interesting thing is the flexibility of remedies in this case. I should, however, add that the hot news misappropriation doctrine is under fire. The Court of Appeal in that case overturned the district court's decision, and there is currently litigation in which Bloomberg is being sued for taking news gathered by someone else, and Bloomberg is challenging the entire doctrine here and asks the court to give up this doctrine. I'm not so interested in details, but I'm interested in the overall picture here. What is happening here in all these cases, which are below the intellectual property threshold, is that there are intangible objects of value which are protected by the courts. The courts are granting a remedy against unauthorized use, but the remedy very much depends on the type of use, on the circumstances of the defendant's behavior, on the circumstances of the individual market. In all of these cases, consent matters. So licensing, in a way, is possible, even if we wouldn't refer to it that way. And we also see that there are remedies in all of these cases which sound a bit like intellectual property remedies, but which may be more flexible. So we might take different policy views on whether these types of protection are sound or whether they are not. Some of you may feel that protection in some of the cases I have mentioned shouldn't have been there in the first place. But a legal realist would observe that some sticks of the property bundle have been granted here while others have been withheld. And that is the only thing that I'm claiming for the moment. Let me move on to my second point, which I would like to refer to as the hybridization of IP, and where I will try to show that in some areas of intellectual property, the courts are moving away from a clear property paradigm and getting closer to what I referred to as hybrids. Let me start by looking at trademark law, which has never been a full intellectual property right like patents. Trademark law developed from unfair competition law, and there are a couple of historical analyses of this. So Professor Bentley, for instance, in his analysis of this 19th century turn from protection against deceit to intellectual property protection, referred to this tendency as from communication to thing. And Andreas Sattler, in his thesis on the history of 20th century European and German trademark law, refers to the tendency of trademark law of expansion and emancipation. So at around 2000, trademark law had sort of reached the high watermark of intellectual property law. And at the moment, one of the issues in trademark law seems to be how to restrict these expansionist tendencies and how to limit trademarks to their proper scope or their proper function, as you might say. And the trademark lawyers among you know these tendencies very well. First of all, the European Court of Justice contains the very broad protection in cases of double identity by introducing the functions theory. It requires that the use must have a negative effect, a detrimental effect on protected trademark functions. The first or the most important function being the origin function. In the Google France case, the Court of Justice said that the origin function is interfered with if consumers either assume a commercial relation between the user and the trademark owner, or unclear as to whether there is such a commercial information, such a commercial connection. So this is a consumer information approach, which we are familiar with from unfair competition law. And this is actually what the European Court says. The European Court draws on transparency requirements in the e-commerce directive. We also find that the functions theory can be a basis for balancing interests, for weighing brand protection on the one hand against consumer information, as the court did in the Interflora case. Also, the test for determining the likelihood of confusion might be changing at the moment. So this test used to be, at least in this country and also in Germany, a fairly formal test, a test very much inspired by intellectual property law, where you compared the trademark as entered into the registry with the sign that was being used by the infringer. Now, the Court of Justice tells us in the O2 case that the infringement analysis is different from the analysis that is carried out at the registration stage, where the registrar compares the older trademark with an earlier sign that is being applied for registration. And also the Specsavers case is, of course, a case in point, where the European Court was prepared to take into account that the Specsavers sign, which was registered in black and white, was actually used in green and white. And this was something that the court, although it was not as such mentioned in the register, took into account when determining infringement. I just co-examined a DPhil thesis in Oxford 2 weeks ago by Luis Enrique Porangaba, and he looks at trademark use, he looks at trademark functions, he analyzes this tendency, and his proposition is that trademark law is getting much more context sensitive. He thinks that's a good thing, and his arguments are pretty convincing, as I found. Should also flag out that at the level of EU trademarks, there is a certain flexibility at the remedies stage when trademarks are infringed in some parts of the EU territory while not in others. When we look at this gradual move away from a property paradigm, I think there are also copyright cases which are very much in point. The classical way to look at copyright infringement would be the classical property paradigm. First of all, we look at the object being a work protected by copyright law. Then we determine scope. Copyright scope is determined by broadly defined rights, the reproduction right, communication to the public, and distribution. And once it has been established that the use comes within copyright scope, the next step or the next thing to do would be to look at exceptions. There is this closed catalog of exceptions in EU law, whereas the exceptions are broader in the US, where there is a fair use doctrine. Now, at least when we look at the Court of Justice's case law on communication to the public, it doesn't quite fit in with this paradigm anymore. The starting point was the Swenson case, which was a case about linking to a legal source. The person up there is Mr. Svensson. He's a Swedish journalist, and his articles were published on the website of the newspaper he was working for with his authorization. And then a news collecting service had actually provided links to this website. And the question was, is that communication to the public? Well, the straightforward answer would have been, no, it's not a communication to the public because it's just a link. The person operating the website is communicating, but not the person providing the link. But as we know, the European Court of Justice chose not to adopt this view, but to adopt a very broad notion of communication, which extends to what you might call indirect communication, that is linking. And then this very broad protection had to be contained again, and the Court of Justice did so by introducing a new public criterion. However, this new public criterion turned out to be inadequate in cases of linking to an illegal source. And this case reached the European Court of Justice pretty soon. That was the GS Media case, in which photos taken of a Dutch starlet and to be published in the Playboy had been leaked on an Australian website somewhere, which nobody would have found had not a Dutch blog, namely the blog Geen Stijl, which translates into No Style, quite a telling motto for this blog, as is the logo, by the way, a girl with a chainsaw. So this blog had actually provided links to this particular website. And here the Court of Justice had to determine whether this was a communication to the public. I'm not really concerned with the details of the case so much, but that the Court of Justice, in determining whether this had been a communication to the public, applied a flexible set of criteria and stressed what it now calls the indispensable role of the user. There are some objective criteria there, the commercial nature of the link, for example, potentially even duties of care. And there is a subjective requirement, namely the requirement that this user intervenes in full knowledge. The court even took account of human rights that were at stake in these cases of linking. So there is a much less object-centered type of reasoning, namely the object is the work and the work has been used. The court is very much looking at the individual act, at the cultural implications, and at the market implications of this particular use. I should say that at the moment it's not quite clear whether this is a general rule or whether it's just a rule which concerns cases that would traditionally have been dealt with under doctrines of secondary liability. I mean, linking the Pirate Bay and all these cases that were decided by the Court of Justice were really cases of secondary liability. So the Court of Justice may not be dissolving the notion of communication to the public altogether, but it may just be applying these flexible criteria in these cases of secondary use. There are also some examples where the Court of Justice still very much clings to property logic, or perhaps not the court, but the Advocate General. And I should mention this case here, which has been with us quite a while in Germany. Actually, litigation started in 2005, and now this case is on the way to the European Court of Justice. The claimants in this case are the German band Kraftwerk, pioneers of electropop, as it were, and a part of their of one of their pieces, two-second snippet of their pieces, has been used in digital sampling by this man, Moses Pelham, the producer, and by this woman here, Sabrina Zettler, a German rapper. And the question was whether digital sampling actually infringes the sound recording right. Again, there is a lot to say about that, and actually just a couple of days ago, I gave a presentation on digital sampling, which took me 45 minutes, so I'm not going to elaborate on this very much right now, you will be relieved to hear, but nevertheless, it's interesting to look at the opinion that was handed down by Advocate General Spunar, because that is typical of property logic. He said a sound recording right is infringed even if small parts are reproduced. Sound recording right protects even small snippets. There is no de minimis rule. There is no flexibility for national courts here. Exceptions, narrowly construed exceptions, do not apply. And fundamental rights only apply as an ultima ratio. They don't really factor into the equation. The Advocate General says, I quote, "Is it conceivable for a painter to rely on his freedom of creation so as not to pay for his paint and paintbrushes?" Well, I think that's a little bit under complex what he is doing there. And this case would have offered a couple of opportunities for a more market sensitive approach along the lines, perhaps, of GS Media. So, for instance, when you ask whether there is a de minimis rule, you might take into account whether the new piece which is being created here is a substitute for the old one, whether the market of the sound recorder is actually harmed or whether it is not. Now, academia has thought about this quite a lot, and I would like to do a little bit of self-advertising here. There is a group of European copyright scholars which published a book edited by Professor Hugenholz in Amsterdam. And really what combines all of these contributions, one of them being my contribution, is that they are all aimed at making economic rights more flexible and more market and context sensitive. Finally, a very brief word on patents. Patents are the archetypical intellectual property right, as it were. The object of the right is defined by registration. Patents have a broad object-oriented scope. That is, it is the invention as defined by the registration which is being protected. The circumstances of the use do not really matter. It's just the use which is infringing. And exceptions are very narrow. Nevertheless, there is a considerable discussion going on worldwide about a tendency towards more flexible remedies. It is US law which is taking the lead here. There is this well-known Supreme Court decision of eBay and Merck Exchange in which the Supreme Court remembered all the US courts that injunctions are granted under flexible principles of equity and in which the Supreme Court subjected the grant of an injunction in patent law cases to a flexible four factors test. In English law, injunctions are also a creature of equity, so there is also some flexibility here, as the courts have also stressed. The approach is nevertheless more cautious, as is witnessed by two judgments handed down by Mr. Justice Arnold. Nevertheless, both of these judgments are very interesting and very worth reading, particularly this one here, which is about an item a medical item which concerned heart valves and which could actually save lives. And so one of the interests factored into the equation here by Mr. Justice Arnold was the public interest in the availability of this particular medical item, which couldn't be taken off the market right away. And so he granted a stay of the injunction for a certain time for markets to adapt and for health care practitioners to adapt to new types of medical products. Germany is very reluctant here. German courts still very much stick to the property paradigm by saying there is a property right, the patent is a property right, and whenever it's infringed, there should be an injunction as a matter of course. There is a recent decision in which the Supreme Court acknowledged that there might be some sort of, that there might be cases of disproportionality, but these cases are very exceptional cases. And in this particular case, in which there would have been reasons to withhold an injunction, the court was not prepared to do so. Actually, in Germany, legislation might intervene. There is some discussion going on about that at the moment. And of course, standard essential patents and FRAND, where the patent owner, if the patent owner has given a FRAND commitment, may not be able to enforce the patents entirely. Again, there is a lot of research about rights which might protect technology below the level of patents. So Professor Reichman, whom I cited at the very beginning, when he was looking at legal hybrids, he was looking at innovation rights, which don't give you the right to an injunction, but only the right to remuneration in types of subsequent innovation. Ted Sickleman, with his suggestion of commercializing patents, weaker, slimmer rights that are granted when a marketable product is being provided, and Gertrui van Overwalle's suggestions at inclusive patents, where once again there is no injunction right available. So, where does this take us? First of all, we can say, or we can see in all of these cases, that some sticks of the bundle are either taken away or that they are at least reduced or made slimmer. And mostly this is a reaction to an expansion of intellectual property rights which had taken part beforehand. So the first stick is the stick that every use of the object is infringing. Courts in some instances, and I showed you these instances, seem to be moving away from this object-oriented perspective to a more act-oriented analysis, to an injection of market and context-related considerations. There is a balancing involved in some of these cases. And finally, there is a more flexible approach to remedies, as we see particularly in the patent law cases. So, where does this leave us? When I prepared my presentation, I found it much easier to describe and to analyze the phenomenon than to come up with normative conclusions and to tell you whether I think that this is a good thing or a bad thing. Let me nevertheless try to come up with at least some tentative propositions, although I must say that a lot more research is necessary here. And I would like to distinguish between three dimensions here: the analytical one, the policy one, and the methodological one. So first of all, analytically, should we talk about hybrids? How about this hybrids talk? Or should we rather adopt the traditional binary view where we distinguish between IP and non-IP? I remember very vividly a conversation that I had recently with my faculty colleague, who is the professor of legal history, and the conversation was not about intellectual property, but about something entirely different. And she said, "I don't like hybrids. Hybrids are always a symptom of a lack of conceptual clarity." And you might say that when you're talking about hybrids, when you're talking about sui generis, there might be the conceptual clarity missing, because that is what doctrine is about, sorting things and particularly determining the borderline between property and non-property. And this borderline might matter in some neighboring areas. Take constitutional law, for instance. There is the constitutional protection afforded to property under the First Protocol to the European Convention of Human Rights, under Article 17 of the European Charter. Conflict of laws, there are different rules for intellectual property and for unfair competition law in the Rome Convention. Remedies, IP remedies, are dealt with by the IP Enforcement Directive, which only applies to intellectual property rights. But then I would probably say that the binary approach is just not an adequate reflection of reality. I think we should take hybrid seriously. And first of all, when we look at the neighboring fields, whenever it's unclear whether something is property or non-property, we should be very, very careful to apply, for example, constitutional law in a formalistic way. When we look at trade secret law, for instance, trade secrets law should be afforded some sort of protection regardless of whether we see it as a property right or whether we don't see it as a property right. The European Court of Human Rights, very much like the German Constitutional Court, by the way, reacts by adopting a very, very broad notion of property, which is much broader than our private law notion. Also, in terms of policy, I think that policy should rather focus on which sticks to allocate rather than talking about IP or non-IP. I know that many people are concerned about property rhetoric. There is property rhetoric on both sides. There are those who say, well, I have a property right and hence it should be protected broadly, whereas there are others who say we should be very careful about property rights because it triggers this reflex. I would argue that given the tendencies that I've tried to show you, the force of property rhetoric is weakening and that it doesn't have as much force as before. Also, we should be aware of something that I would refer to as a reverse property rhetoric. It's the fallacy of underestimating types of protection which are just tort law or just unfair competition law, and hence they do not matter. Well, they do matter because in many respects they equal property protection. Let me look at the... Oh, come on. Don't leave me just before the end. At the policy dimension, how about hybrids as risks? When you looked at some of the cases that I talked about, you may have felt that protection was going too far in those cases. And indeed you might claim that hybrids threaten legal certainty. You might argue that a clear definition of rights is the corollary of freedom, and that also a clear allocation of rights is the condition of licensing and of contracting. So you might say these hybrids are risky because they might result in a covert restriction of freedoms. Parliament should draw the line and not judges by allowing hybrid types of protection. However, sorry for these. Okay, but the world may just have become too complex a place for a purely binary approach. When the entire intellectual property system was devised in the 19th century, you got a patent for a machine. You got a copyright which enabled you to produce and sell a book, and you attached your trademark to a particular product. Whereas in these days, the types of use are getting more complex, and the items that are being or not being protected by intellectual property law are getting more complex. So my plea or my argument would be, let us allow flexibility in the intellectual property system. When looking at intellectual property infringement, economic and cultural context matter. And sometimes we may not need the full intellectual property right. Some sticks of the bundle may be sufficient in some situations, while others may not be necessary. Let me move on to my last dimension, namely the methodological dimension. Of course, there is the risk of legal certainty and of judicial idiosyncrasy when we speak about vague notions that we have seen on both sides of the borderline, on the non-IP side and on the IP side. And let me quote Professor Reichman's article, which I referred to at the beginning of my talk. Empirically, unfair competition norms, he was referring to unfair competition, but we might say the same thing about the other flexible notions that I've been mentioning. Empirically, unfair competition norms enable courts to adopt temporary measures to alleviate the tensions that arise from gaps in the domestic system of innovation. Over time, however, when legislatures fail to intervene or when they choose to intervene inopportunely, courts applying these amorphous principles of unfair competition law tend to become part of the problem rather than agents of any real solution. I think this risk is to be taken seriously. So one of the tasks for legal research in this area will be to search for the appropriate mix of legislation and judicial discretion. There are a couple of methods that I have already investigated a little bit further in the context of copyright law and that I would just like to flag out here. One possibility is the creation of blacklists, which we find in some areas, for instance, in European Union unfair competition law, which define very clear cases in a very simple and straightforward way. Another legislative method might be a criteria or a catalogue of statutory principles of criteria, as we find them in the US fair use test, and as we find them in the trade secrets directive, where injunctions are subjected to a catalogue of criteria. Then, of course, case law gradually, over time, turns into clusters of cases and into doctrines, which then in turn can be adopted by legislation and which can be cast into a statute. So I think there are some possibilities, some methodological possibilities of dealing with uncertainty here. Which brings me to the end. As you saw, I've made a strong analytical proposition and a weak policy proposition. The strong analytical proposition is that hybrids are there on both sides of the intellectual property threshold, and that this intellectual property threshold is getting increasingly blurred. Hybrids are increasingly important. Hybrids are here to stay. The policy implications are much less clear. I advocated in favor of flexibility. I think both when applying intellectual property rights and when applying hybrid forms of protection, there should be scope for flexibility. And one of the great tasks for legal research is to cope with that flexibility and to develop a methodology of dealing with these types of uncertainty. So my final plea or my final proposition would be, let's take hybrids seriously. Thank you very much for your attention.